Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network. My name's Christopher Davey. I'm the Charles E. Scheidt Visiting Assistant Professor at the Strauss Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Clark University. And I'm here today to talk with Anna Hedlund about her recent book, Hutu Rebels, Exile Warriors in the Eastern Congo. Anna works in the Faculty of Sociology at Lund University. So Anna, go ahead. Please, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself before we start talking about the book.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I have a PhD in social anthropology, and I'm currently working as a researcher at the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Lund University in Sweden. And I have studied conflict and violence for the past decade. And I guess this journey began when I was part of a research group that was investigating actually rape and sexual violence in the Pacific region. And I then became interested in trying to understand how perpetrators themselves justify acts of violence and the everyday life and local politics of conflict. So that led me to conduct fieldwork in the Eastern Congo for my PhD. And so far, my research focus has mainly been on understanding the inner dynamics of armed groups, the motives and root causes of violence in war, and victim-perpetrator dichotomies. And after my PhD, I did a postdoc at the Center for Social Change in Johannesburg in South Africa. And I then applied for a Marie Curie Research Fellowship together with Dignity, the Danish Institute Against Torture in Denmark, where I was based for 2 years. And during this time, I also carried out fieldwork in the Kivu regions in the Congo, but with a slightly different focus. So after those projects, I moved back to Sweden again, and I am currently working on a new research project on gun violence and crime prevention in Sweden. And the book that we will talk about today is based on the fieldwork and the research that I did in the Congo.
Yeah. Great. Thanks very much. It's great to be able to, we're going to hear a little bit about your current research because I want to throw that in at the end. But if you could maybe just tell us a little bit about who the FDLR are and what some of the main points of the book are, if you could.
Yeah, so the FDLR is an acronym that stands for the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. And this is a group that was formed after the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. When thousands of people, both victims and perpetrators, fled the genocide in Rwanda and they crossed the border to the Eastern Congo. So originally the FDLR was composed by people who had participated in the genocide in Rwanda as military officials and army soldiers, but also They were composed by Rwandan refugees. And today the group is much more diverse and fragmented, and it's composed by Rwandan and Congolese refugees. And some of them have nothing to do with the genocide that happened in 94. So the purpose on writing this book was to tell a story about this group of Rwandan Hutu rebels who live in a rebel camp in the very remote area in the highlands of the Congo. So in the book, I explore how this community of about 300 people, both rebels and refugees, speak about the war and their understandings of violence and their everyday lives being an active rebel group in a very complex and complicated situation. So based on ethnographic fieldwork, participant observations and interviews with rebel leaders and fighters that are currently involved in the conflict, the book provides an analysis of everyday life in a rebel camp and an understanding of violence in the Kivu region from the perspective of the perpetrators and their families. So in the book, I try to explore how this group justify violence. So this is how they justify violence in the Congo, but also in Rwanda. And I'm also looking at how they tried to rewrite the official narrative of the Rwandan genocide and investigate how violence is produced in the camp setting and how violence is transferred from one generation to another, for example, in propaganda, in songs, military performances, narratives and prayers and so on. In the book, I also discuss and unpack the complex categories of victims and perpetrators, and I show how the rebels themselves believe that they are victims and how such understandings lead to the justification of violence. So, for example, in their perception, they're trying to protect themselves from Rwanda, the Congolese military, and other armed groups in the region. So I showed that although this is true, it's also a way to legitimize violence. The book, it also explores various dimensions of violence. I show, for example, how the camp was a setting where violence was actually not taking place, but that everyday life in the rebel camp was explained as being extremely difficult. So they live in small houses made of bamboo. They have no water, electricity, and so on. And everyday life is much about securing access to food, about routines, going to the church and simply waiting. So they have been living in these camps for over 25 years. But of course, violence is still present in the sense that they speak about violence. They have a very long and complicated history of violence. They are armed, they train, they do military trainings and so on. And they also carry out attacks against civilians and so on. So I think that's the purpose of the book. And probably I should also say that in the region, this group is often referred to as the genocidas because of their so-called genocide ideology. So when this group was formed for more than 25 years ago, the goal was to return to Rwanda and to retake power in Kigali. But today they would claim that they have little to do with the genocide, and they are still in conflict with the Rwandan state, as well as with the Congolese state. And like I said, in the Kivu regions, they have a very long and difficult history They've been divided in different factions. They have different political and military goals and so on. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, that's really helpful. And one of the things that struck me as I, you know, read the book is that contrast, right? You start one of the chapters with that scene from Johnny Mad Dog, right? The film that depicts popular ideas about child soldiers and about rebel groups. And you very quickly demystify that in the context of the FDLR, which I think was really helpful, right? To really get into that level of the day. So you mentioned earlier, you know, the background of your research, your involvement in that research group that looked at sexual violence and the justification of violence. So given that background, how was it that you came to focusing specifically on the FDLR?
Yes, so when I first began to explore and to do research on perpetrators and violence in the Congo, I actually first began to do interviews in demobilization camps, and I was interviewing combatants, soldiers, former child soldiers from many different armed groups. And through these contacts and people that I met in the field, I was then able to access a rebel camp. And so initially I thought that this project was not going to be about one single group, but also after spending time and conducting fieldwork in the rebel camp, I decided to focus on one group in order to better, I guess, capture the understanding of violence and to achieve this more holistic understanding of art groups and violence.
Thank you. And, you know, and this is one of the things that I found quite interesting about the book is that it does give us that quite in-depth approach, whereas the FDLR typically is one of those groups that kind of pops up because of that deep connection to Rwanda and their involvement in Congo. We have very little outside of your book, we have very little in terms of that sort of deeper holistic understanding of who they are and you know, how they see themselves, importantly as well.
Yeah, true. And I think that most of the studies that exist are written by human rights organizations. So I think that it's also been quite little research on the FDLR.
Definitely. Yeah. So the one thing, you know, for readers of the book, one of the most fascinating things about, you know, what you've done here is kind of the process, right, that you undertook. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your research design and some of the fieldwork challenges that you had. How did that all come together for you?
So I'll start with the fieldwork experiences, I think. So I think that doing fieldwork in a conflict setting is challenging for obvious reasons. There is no reliable information. There are many rumors. Perpetrators have this tendency to speak about themselves in a certain way, highlighting only certain issues while ignoring or avoiding others and so on. And the conflict in the Congo is also highly political and complicated. And there are also many victims of violence, and many people have suffered from violence for many generations. So it's also quite an emotional setting where many people have traumatic memories. They are suspicious to outsiders, for example, and there is a general lack of trust, I think, especially towards the international community. So it's difficult. It's definitely a difficult context to work in. I think that doing research on perpetrators also poses unique methodological and ethical questions. For example, it can be difficult to get access. It's also sensitive to write about perpetrators. And perpetrators may also themselves be traumatized and so on. I think it's also quite difficult when it comes to representations and to how to minimize risks and so on. As an anthropologist, I was interested in how people themselves speak about the life situations and how they explain violence, and also how they, you know, how they present themselves. And of course, to them, I was a foreign researcher that they invited to the camp. And this also meant that it was a lot of propaganda. At least in the beginning, they presented only one side of the story and a very strong victim narrative. And it was also quite difficult to access people who lived in the camp that were not soldiers. So, for example, the women and elders, since I think also that the leaders tried to maintain control over interactions and so on. But I think this was also an interesting finding in itself. Yeah, so the camp, it was also a very hierarchical setting, and where the leaders, for example, kept this controlled over different interactions. And I was also somehow dependent on their knowledge of the situation. So I think, so in anthropology, we usually say that trust and access is the goal for gathering this good data. But I think it was extremely difficult to gain trust in the rebel camp. And I think this is true in any war zone or any conflict area. But this is not to say that I wasn't welcomed in the camp. In fact, the rebels and the combatants were very friendly, polite, and they treated me with respect. And I think this was also mutual. And I really had a keen interest to listen to the stories, to learn more about the life, and really try to understand why they continue to fight this seemingly endless war. Yeah, I think it's also quite on a more personal level, it can also be quite difficult not to be engaged by people's life situations. And some of the people in the camp, for example, are definitely victims and or refugees, and they have nothing to do with the surrounding war. So I think it there were many challenges, but I do think also that these methodological and ethical questions need more attention in perpetrator research, and that they are always part of the difficulties of doing research in conflict areas. Yeah.
That's really helpful. Thank you. And there has been, and as we both know, right, there's been some work to try and address that gap recently. Mm. But it seems like one of the things again that you bring in the book here is that, you know, definitely the anthropological lens, but at least I got, as I read it, right, a feeling of a bit more of an interdisciplinary approach, trying to keep in mind like all these other different ways of dealing with perpetrators. Mm. In addition to, you know, a lot of the material out there already that can tend to be quite legally influenced or like shaped around building cases against perpetrators and establishing guilt and so on.
Exactly.
The next question I was going to ask you was around the group's interaction with the surroundings, but I want to just pick up on something you said earlier, and you kind of addressed this a little bit. I was wondering if you might be able to say a bit more. And it's something that I've encountered as well, that, you know, when you go into situations where you have a highly organized group where there's hierarchy, you do tend to have quite a lot of sort of perpetrator speak, if you will, like, mm. as you mentioned, and that then becomes, you know, you can see it as being highly subjective and highly selective in the way that things are presented to you. Are there ways in which, you know, you as a researcher kind of dealt with this? Did it lead to sort of additional questioning and challenging, or was it more about sort of observing and sort of kind of taking note of how those views were being presented?
Yes. So in the camp, what I tried to do was to mostly observe and to do, of course, interviews and to get this, to get this like understanding of what is going on in the camp. And by doing that, I think I also could avoid a little bit these more, so for example, they did these military performances where it was obvious that they were trying to present to me one certain narrative. But by being there for quite some time and getting to know people and having more informal conversations, I could also deconstruct that image, if that makes sense.
It definitely does make sense. One of the, the quite intriguing elements of the book is the one scene of the reenactment, or I guess it's a sort of a future hoped enactment of the International Criminal Court, where you have Kagame and the international community, represented with, some major, or people sort of standing in for major countries. And that, again, right, is a fascinating piece of kind of performance work and demonstration of that narrative.
Yeah.
So the next question I had for you was just about sort of this kind of multi-directional relationship that the FDLR had with their surroundings. So how was it that the group shaped their surroundings in sort of this remote location in Eastern Congo?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. But this group, they have been in the region for a very long time. They have this, this very long and complicated history with the Rwandan government, with the Congolese government, and with many different local armed groups in the region. So this also means that they have enemies and they have friends, but they also shift alliances and they form new networks. And this is depending on the surrounding situation. So it's quite difficult to follow, I think, how they actually shift and form these alliances. But also in some areas in the Kivu region, they live together with the Congolese population, whereas in other areas, they are enemies with the local population. I would say that they are also dependent on these alliances with the surrounding communities. So, for example, they can provide security to villages in exchange for food and so on. And so in one way, they are dependent on the local population, but they also exercise power over villages. So it's depending on many factors, I would say, such as local political, economic, survival, security, and so on. But I do think that has been the hardest research question to figure out actually how they are actually shaping their surroundings, because they tend to shift these alliances all the time and very often.
Thank you. So just to kind of keep things a little bit more general before I dive into some very specific questions, what was the most surprising thing that you found as you were out there, given the things that you knew already, having sort of worked in the area before and having worked in sort of thematically in this area, what was the thing that surprised you the most as you got into the camp?
Well, first of all, I think it was the isolation of the camps and the remoteness of the camp. And it was surprising to find that history and this identity of being Hutu, of being a rebel, of being an exile, was so present in their everyday life in this very isolated setting. But also that the genocide has not been forgotten among the people in the camp, although it happened more than, 27 years ago, 28 maybe. And even though some individuals, like the children, for example, have never been to Rwanda, they still speak about the country as their promised land, and they have not given up the dream to return to Rwanda, even though they've never been there. And I think that also the isolation of this camp has formed a very strong community among the people who share these very strong feelings of exclusion. And those feelings of exclusion are also part of shaping ideologies and aspiration. But it was also clear that the leadership in the camp exercised control over the people. And I was also a little bit surprised to find that they are tired of fighting this war, but they still can't give up. And this is partly because of the politics in the region. They have nowhere to go. So they believe that they can't return to Rwanda and they cannot stay and integrate in the Congo. So in one way, they're also stuck in the forests. That's what they think.
Mm. I was going to ask you, I'll ask you a little bit later about the role of survival. And again, right, this is all part of that demystifying of the rebel group, whether it be in the Eastern Congo or elsewhere, that, you know, life is full of more of these routines and much more mundane than we perhaps might think it is. Mm. Before we move on to that, I wondered if you might be able to say anything about any reaction that the FDLR or the wider Rwandan Hutu diaspora or even the Rwandan state has had to the work that you've done, if you had any response.
I think the short answer to that question is no, not that much. But there has been an interest from, let's say, the international community who's working in the region, so from NGOs and so on. But not so much from the diaspora.
Yeah. That's really helpful. Thank you. And again, right, it's, we kind of observe all those things. And I think that my just opinion is that, you know, the lack of response is perhaps because of the nuanced view that you present in the book, that it doesn't, you know, doesn't kind of fit into either group's, you know, if we look at sort of the broader debates and around Rwanda and memory, the narrative that you present in the book doesn't fit into sort of either camp, if you will, and it's hard to sort of define it as, you know, those that are either for or against Kagame. I think the book, you know, presents some of that nuance that's really kind of missing from some of that debate. So one of the other things in terms of like a little bit more depth here that you really address in the book was the role of religious belief and religious institutions. I wonder if you could say a little bit about the role that these things played in camp life.
So religion, I would say, played a major role in the camp. They had, for example, two churches in the camp, one Catholic church and a Protestant church. And also, I found that the leaders of the camp were also the spiritual leaders. So they were also the priests and the pastors. And many prayers were about the promised land, Rwanda, and their hopes to go back one day. When I observed church ceremonies and church activities, you could also see that in many prayers and in many songs, and they were also about crying out their pains, and they talked all the time about the difficult life that they live in the forest. They prayed about being ignored by the international community and the rest of the world. So I think that the church was also a place where they sort of dealt with traumas and pains and so on. But at the same time, many prayers also included propaganda-like messages. And so, like I said before, even the children who had never been to Rwanda could pray about how they were being misinterpreted and they complained about the horrible life that they were living in the forest. And everyone went to church every day. And much of everyday life was organized or formed around different church activities. So it definitely played a major role.
Thank you. And it definitely seems then that it played sort of this multi-purposed role for everybody in the camp, that it seems like it was an outlet, but then an outlet for sort of personal feeling and their sort of grievance with their position that they're in, exactly. But then also reinforce those power structures within the camp as well. I think this for me, that was in terms of it being an anthropological study, some of the the really rich observations came as you were there observing religious life and worship, and some of that the detail of, again, right, the sort of multi-purpose role of religion really sort of came out in those observations. So I thought it was a really really great part of the book.
Thank you.
So the next question I have for you was around sort of the experience of Congolese recruits. You mentioned that the FDLR that we have now is not a carbon copy or not the same as those Rwandan perpetrators who fled from Rwanda in the middle of 1994. Mm. And I wondered if you got a sense for kind of like the difference of experience between, young Congolese who've become part of the FDLR versus maybe older, definitely Rwandan, commanders or leaders that have been part of it for longer.
Mm. Mm. I think this is also quite a difficult question to research, and I've heard many different stories. I do believe that many leaders and combatants are in fact no longer from the 94 generation. And like you said, that many combatants are born in the camps in the Congo. But also that the elders are refugees from Rwanda, but I don't believe that they necessarily had anything to do with the genocide as perpetrators, but that they did arrive in the Kivus as refugees. So this is still a little bit of a mystery, I think. Like, how many are they? How powerful are they? What is their resources and so on? And in the book, I only write about this small community of rebels and refugees. And this also means that I'm not quite sure how other camps are structured, and there is very little information about that too. And it's quite difficult to find out. Also because they are, they are blended with Congolese communities and other armed groups and so on. I've heard different stories, but I do think that the majority is not from the 94 generation, I would say.
Mm, thank you. So for me, one of the biggest takeaways from the book was about, again, going back to this kind of deromanticizing and thinking about and observing the everyday aspects of the camp. And so what would you say the role of survival was in the camp, and sort of observations you made about sort of the wider everyday life for the FDLR or members of the FDLR?
Yes, for the majority of the members of the FDLR, and from what I could observe in the camp, are living quite a difficult life where they have little access to food, little access to other resources and so on. But I've also heard about those rebel leaders, for example, that are quite well off. So it definitely depends on what role in the group you have. But most of the refugees or the women and the children would say that they find it quite difficult to survive. They complain about being hungry, that they don't have any medicine and so on. I think this is also quite a political thing for the FDLR, because many of those I interviewed often said that they want to be recognized as refugees, because that being granted that refugee label would also give them access to resources and supply, for example, from the UNHCR. So many said that they wanted to be, you know, to have this refugee status because that would give access to food, tents, medicine, and so on. So this is a political category, I think, especially when it comes to the FDLR. And because the UNHCR cannot offer any support to groups that are active in the conflict, so the majority of those I spoke to said that they wanted to have this refugee status instead so that they could get access to other supplies.
Mm. And I suppose a lot of that, like you said, is kind of caught up in a lot of the politics.
Exactly.
And the, you know, this sort of longstanding place that the FDLR has and this constellation of other rebel groups in the East that, you know, make peace and security very elusive.
Yeah, exactly.
So thinking about this element of survival, and just maybe casting sort of a broader net here about, you know, why this kind of classic question about why people fight or say they're fighting. And it seemed like, you know, what you were describing in the book was, you know, this group that says that they're fighting to return to Rwanda, but actually as I read, it seemed like they were more fighting just to survive, but weren't willing to describe it as such because, you know, maybe the ideology or power structure didn't allow them to describe it as in that way.
Yeah, true. And I think this also has to do with that so for example, the leaders can't return to Rwanda. And they can't stay in Congo because of the crimes they have committed in the region. So I think that's also is becoming one of the reasons why they have to stay in the forest and why they have to keep on going. But you're definitely right that the majority say that they are tired of this fighting and this war.
Mm. Yeah. And we got the sense of that through, I think, one or two of the participants or informants that you spoke to that had been able to extract themselves somehow from the camp. And as they sort of reflect back on their time and you know, you had some communication with them, that they kind of demonstrated that, I don't know, that difficult spot that they're in.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks very much. I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I wonder if you might be able to tell us a little bit more about what you're working on at the moment whilst you're there in Sweden.
So at the moment I am working on a research project on gun violence and crime prevention in Sweden. So it's a little bit different from working in the Congo, but I'm still working on questions around violence and so on. And gun violence is actually one of the most debated topics here at the moment because there's been an increase of young men shooting other young men. And so I'm trying to figure out why we see this increase in violence now and how we can reduce gun violence.
And notwithstanding the huge, you know, gap between, you know, Sweden and South Kivu and Eastern Congo, are there any sort of themes that you've seen come out already in the research you're doing, thinking back to, you know, some perhaps themes or similarities to what you saw among the FDLR?
That's a very interesting question. I think that, so what I do in this research is that I also do interviews with gang members and people involved in shootings as perpetrators, as victims. So that is quite similar. And what I can see is that a lot of that their understandings of violence is actually quite similar. So most of them would also say that, the violence they have committed or in the way that they talk about fear, for example, the ways they are talking about traumas, the ways that they are framing why they are doing this type of violence. So yeah, there are definitely similarities, but also it's very difficult to compare the two cases because they're so different.
Yes, yeah, definitely, yeah. So just, I suppose, one more question before we wrap up here, just to go back. And I know, you know, your work was definitely, you know, concentrated on this, the one camp, and it's, you know, been a bit of time since you were last in the field, but I wondered if, since writing the book, you've had any reflections on what you think the future holds for the FDLR in particular.
The future of the FDLR, it's quite hard to predict, but I do believe that they are getting weaker and that their leadership is actually not so strong anymore. But at the same time, when I did the fieldwork in the camp, there seemed to be a very strong, you know, this strong perception and ideology shared by everyone in the camp that they will stay in the forest and that they will fight until justice is perceived. But then at the same time, they seem to be tired of fighting. And most of the younger ones also told me that, you know, they want to live a normal life. So I hope that there is a way to handle this, to deal with this dilemma and to also find a way how to help children and women leave the group. And I guess that would also weaken the group even more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, in the book, you definitely get a sense that, at least in this camp, that the power structure is sustained by involvement, you know, sort of across generations and through, you know, men, women, and children being part of this one unit. And it sort of gives that sense of solidarity that, you know, at times seems exploited and, you know, part of what supports that hierarchy mm-hmm. Within the camp.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, again, thanks very much for your time. And, you know, I very much enjoyed reading the book, and it's one that I've been recommending to my students who are interested in the region.
Oh, thank you.
So I have one last question for you that, you know, typically gets asked here on the New Books Network. Is, you know, what reading or maybe even watching any film you might recommend to listeners or readers that have an interest in the kind of work that you're doing?
Yeah, there are many great readings, I think, about the dynamics of conflicts in the Great Lakes region, and also many fantastic books and research about the genocide in Rwanda, violence in the Congo, and so on. But in terms of understanding violence, I would actually recommend the books by Primo Levi and his on the concentration camps in Poland. I think they are extremely well-described descriptions about how people find ways to survive, even in the most difficult situations. And I think they are... I think you could definitely learn about violence from reading those books. So that would be my one recommendation. But it's difficult. There are so many great readings.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, his. I just to comment on that briefly, that, you know, his books on that topic of survival, I think, are really pertinent. Going back to kind of where we started in the beginning and thinking about perpetrators and perpetration and, you know, the journey that sort of discourse has been on, for us to kind of pull it back and to think about survival and violence and agency as in the way that you know, address it in the book, really kind of gets us down to the kind of the everyday level and dynamics. So yeah. Great recommendation. Excellent. Well, thanks again for your time. This has been the New Books in Genocide Studies. We've been talking to Anna Hedlund on her book, Hutu Rebels in Exile Warriors, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. So thanks very much, Anna.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks.